Chain Crew Podcast, powered by the California Youth Football Alliance.
Welcome to another Chain Crew Podcast. We are the voice of California Youth Football. I'm Steve Famiano, along with my co-partner today, Ron White. We've lost our other co-partner, Joe Rafter. I think he's off eating tasty cakes or something like that.
Most definitely.
That Philly special, right? How you doing today, Ron?
I'm doing good. Joe's not here, but he's probably doing exactly what you're talking about.
Right, exactly. On the line with us right now is our special guest today. And more than just a special guest, he's actually become a really good friend of ours and a working colleague in regards to youth football. And that's Dr. Peter Cummings. Peter, how are you today?
I'm great, guys. Thanks for having me. I got to ask you a question up front, though. What is a tasty cake? Is that a California thing?
Let me be clear about this. It is clearly not a California treat. Joe would have to be on. It's just more continuous Philadelphia nonsense is how I characterize it.
Okay. Yeah, there's Joe's from Philadelphia. So, right. You know, it's not about Hostess cupcakes. It's about tasty cakes because tasty cakes are produced in Philadelphia.
Gotcha.
And that leads me to the first question I'm actually going to ask you, Peter, and Ron kind of set us up for this. So every guest that we have on the Chain Crew Podcast moving forward, we're going to ask them their three top sports teams. It's going to be football, baseball, and basketball. Who is your football team, your NFL team?
Steelers, straight up. Ever since the 1970s, I've been a Steelers fan. But that being said, I love Tom Brady, so if they're not playing the Steelers, then you know I'll always pull for TV.
All right, well that's good. So then your baseball team?
Home team, Red Sox.
Red Sox, okay, that makes sense. And then the most important, your basketball team.
Celtics.
Celtics. Okay, so
home team, you see.
home team. I was gonna tell you, if you were gonna say the 76ers, we were gonna cut this interview short.
I think that's Joe's department there, Philly, isn't it?
No, you would think that, sir. But that's actually my team, made its way all the way to California. I am a Sixer fan as well.
Yeah, he's a Sixer fan.
They had some great teams, though, back in the day. They had some great teams.
They did have some great teams. He's a Sixers fan, a Mets fan, and a Dallas Cowboys fan. So we're still trying to figure that all out. But we appreciate you telling us your teams on that one. You know, we're going to talk some youth football stuff today. But first, I want to get into a little bit about your background. I think a lot of people pretty much know what you're all about. But if you can kind of give those who are listening a little taste of what it is you do and how you got into youth football.
Yeah, well, it started for me when I was about six. And my sister fell off her bike and she gashed her chin open on some railroad tracks. And she came, it happened across the street from the hospital in my little town, but instead of going into the emergency room, she came home and she's covered in blood and it's very dramatic. And I remember seeing this and going to the emergency room and watching the doctor do the stitches on her chin. And I thought, oh my God, this is incredible. This is what I want to do with my life. And that's sort of how I became a nerd and getting into science and wanting to be a doctor was, you know, watching my sister hemorrhage. And when she went back to have the stitches out, the doctor let me use the forceps to the tweezers to pull out one of the stitches. And I thought that was pretty awesome. But I wanted to do sports medicine and orthopedics. And I kind of envisioned my life as sitting around doing ACL surgeries. When I was in graduate school at a university in Nova Scotia called Dalhousie University, I was at a reception for new students and new people to the department. And all my classes were in the pathology department because they were very medically oriented. I didn't know anybody and there was a wine table. And, you know, so what do you do when you're a graduate student and you gravitate to the free booze? And there was another guy there who didn't know anybody. And we started drinking and talking and he was the new chief medical examiner for Nova Scotia. And he and I became friends and I started to spend some time hanging out with him. And then a Swiss Air jumbo jet crashed off the coast of Nova Scotia, called Swiss Air Flight 111. And I spent 2 years working on the identifications of those people. And that's sort of where I fell into doing forensic pathology. And it wasn't until I was in medical school when I really, really fell in love with the brain, neuroanatomy and neuroscience, and sort of had a career crisis moment. What was I going to do? Am I going to do? I thought about neurosurgery for a while, ended up settling on doing neuropathology and forensics. So I get to do a little bit of the brain. I get to do, you know, the forensic stuff that I enjoy. And what I do now, I mean, my whole world centers around head trauma, determining how injuries happen, patterns of injuries. That's sort of my jam.
So for those who don't understand what pathology and the forensic side mean, what are the difference in those? Because there's somewhat of a difference, right?
Oh, it's a big difference.
Okay.
Pathology is a general science of studying diseases and disease processes of the human body. And within that, you have subspecialties where you can focus on different things. Some people will focus on heart pathology. Some people will focus on liver pathology. And, you know, I focus on brain pathology. And there's another area of pathology called forensic pathology, where you train to understand mechanisms of injury and you look at unnatural deaths, you know, things you would think about with the homicides and suicides, accidents, and determining how and why those people died. When I combine the two of those two subspecialties of pathology, I really look at how people die traumatically from head injury.
When we talk about CTE, and that's a big topic right now, where does CTE fit in? More on the pathology side or the forensic side?
Well, it's more the neuropathology side. The forensic pathology work that I do doesn't really touch on much of the world of CTE, other than, you know, the idea that we can probably get into this, the idea that people with CTE are, you know, committing suicide. That's where it might come into forensics. Most of my forensic work is I do a lot of work for free for innocence projects around the country and around the world, doing post-conviction stuff where if people are put into prison for bad science, going back and seeing if the science really was bad and trying to get new trials for people who may have been convicted wrongly for crimes. And they could be stabbings and shootings and strangulations, all the different sort of violent ways that people can die. That's most of what I do with forensics.
In some regards, with the youth football discussion that's going on and you being involved in it now and being in the field that you're in, as far as your expertise in this field of the brain, you're the guy that we would want to go to. I mean, if we're a parent that wants to sign our kids up for football, youth football, we would say, who would you go to? You're going to believe the coach, you're going to believe the doctor. For you, it's more of, you are in the field of the brain and you are a youth football coach also. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. So you have the unique aspect of being able to tell that story.
Yeah. How I open some of the talks I give about this is the only person I know of in this conversation. And I use that term loosely because there's not a lot of conversation happening here, which is the problem. I don't know anybody else who's a forensic pathologist, who's done, you know, thousands of autopsies and cut thousands of brains, who understands the complexities of the brain and trauma, who's also, you know, a neuropathologist who has taken the time to learn about football, coach football, both flag football and tackle football, has a child that plays the sport. I touch every area of that. And the interesting thing about those intersections of parent, coach, and neurotrauma expert is that I never intended really to be a football dad or a football coach. I say that my son plays football because I reached these decisions. I didn't reach these decisions because my son plays football. And I was just like every other parent in this country, asking the same questions, reading the same New York Times articles, the same fears of every parent. And it wasn't until I took a really hard look at stuff that I started to see that, wait a second, you know, what we're seeing out there in the media isn't very accurate. And granted, I have a special set of tools and that I can speak brain. So I have an advantage, and I feel like, you know, I have a response. The thing that just grinds my gears is bad science. I mean, for me, this has really stopped being about youth football a long time ago. This is about science for me. And I can't sit by and see the scientific process abused the way that it is and do nothing about it, particularly because it affects my family, families of friends of mine. The knock-on effect is tremendous. And I can't sit by and do nothing.
No, Peter, I'm so glad you touched on those points, right? And your skill set and what you've experienced is probably second to none as it relates to the crossover and playing in multiple roles in youth football. Let me ask you a question for the average football mom or parent who is maybe struggling with the decision to play or hopefully even listening to the podcast. How does your average parent who has to sift through article after article, who's bombarded with what appears to be a slanted media narrative, really start to sort out fact from fiction with all the CTE concussion rhetoric that's out there, how would you help those parents sift through and once again, sort through that level of fact versus fiction?
It's a huge task. And there was a University of Massachusetts Lowell poll that came out a couple of years ago. And I'd love to talk about this because it really, I think Ron hits your point very, very strongly. So they said that 60% of parents have no idea what Pop Warner or youth sports organizations are doing to promote safety. So one of the things that we need to do is we need to be better at educating our parents, doing podcasts like this. I think that these bills to ban tackle football was the best thing to ever happen for football because it got Pop Warner coaches talking to American youth football coaches, to USA football coaches, and we're all cross-pollinating. We're all talking about how we're going to talk to parents. We're all talking about how we can do a better job of getting that information to parents. That is, I think, the biggest thing that we can do to have the biggest impact on our sport is to let people know what's going on. And I think for a long time, we've been very reactive to that. And I think that until very recently, a lot of coaches were terrified when parents came up to them and, you know, uncomfortable talking about CTE and uncomfortable talking about concussion. And now there are other resources that they can point to and say, look, read this or take a look at this and come to a practice. I think it's opened up coaches more to that dialogue. And I think that targeting the 60% is really the key and doing better at communicating our points.
Yeah, you know, I think you're spot on, Peter, when you say that, because a little over a year ago, before all these bans were introduced, I think we were all just in our local communities kind of doing our thing in youth football, taking whatever precautions we needed to take. And we've done a lot, even without having to be pushed by legislators. I do believe that there's many of us that have been in youth football for a very long time, have stepped up to the plate and made changes without being forced to make changes. But you said something that was very key for me, the Save Youth Football movements, the alliances that are starting now, what it's done, it actually has made youth football a stronger entity across the country.
100% agree with that. And I tell coaches all the time, you know, this is the time to brag, guys. This is the time to tell people all the wonderful things you're doing. Brag, you know, you spend a lot of time putting these programs together, and let's pat yourself on the back a little bit. Tell people how awesome you are.
Why do you think that youth tackle football seemingly draws all the media attention when we know that there's some level of inherent risk in almost any type of sport or contact activity? What's your thoughts on that?
I think because it's low-hanging fruit. Even though we do have three really large governing bodies, USA Football, Pop Warner, and American Youth Football, even though we have these things around the country, everybody's been in a very reactive state to this. And if you want to benefit from change, you have to initiate the change. It's hard to go after the NFL because they have a lot of money. It's hard to go after the NCAA, again, because they're a big machine. Youth football are little programs all over the place, and they're easy targets. Because we haven't been united like this. That's really been the major issue, is that it hasn't been a very united front across the country like what we're seeing right now.
I think that's the most exciting part for me. It's
I get excited, but bring the bills. Let's go. What's the next state? You know, because all we're going to do is make this sport better. Bring it. You know, I love it. It's a chance Absolutely. To talk about football and get more people involved, talk to more parents. Man, it's great PR for us.
It is great PR because, like you said, go out there and shine the spotlight on yourself and your local community and say, and raise your hand and say, look, Mr. or Mrs. Legislator, look what we've done in our own backyard. Look at what we're doing for the kids in our community. Exactly. It is a very, very good thing. Now, Peter, I'm going to ask you kind of some medical stuff here that it's been on the top of my mind for a long time now, and trying to get some clarification on what these terms mean and how they relate, because this is part of what I call the narrative against the sport of youth football and football in general.
All right, I thought you were going to get real personal on me and show me a rash or something.
That's later in the show. Yeah, we both are going to do that. That's later in the show. I'm itching right now.
Let me tell you, what? My doctor said this. What do you think? You
know? Well, wait a minute now. Are you diagnosed? I mean, are you certified to diagnose a rash?
Hey, I am a fully licensed physician. If I wanted to, I could put you on my kitchen table and take out your appendix.
That's good to know. That's one for the whole family. I appreciate that.
Oh, man, that's great. No, what I want to ask you is, because you hear these terms a lot, you hear subconcussive. It's almost like a stages of what can happen to the brain. You hear subconcussive, concussion, a mild traumatic brain injury, CTE. You know, and then you hear brain damage. Now is the new term that they're, it's like brain, you have brain damage if you played football. How do all those terms relate to each other? And pick one to start with, wherever you want to go with that. I know I threw a lot at you there, but what do they all mean to each other in the scope of this debate?
And it's very important to be clear on all of those terms, because they're confusing. When you read about them in various media sources, they are used in a confusing way. One of the biggest things I think we can do to enhance this attempt at having a dialogue is to separate the terms concussion and CTE, because they're not the same thing. So let's talk about CTE first. CTE is the chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And what that term implies is that you have chronic or continuing brain damage following or changes in your brain following an injury that leads to an encephalopathy, which is a clinical syndrome of altered mental state, altered cognition, altered motor functions, the things that your brain does. What CTE actually is it's a pathologic description of a protein deposition in the brain. All right, so what that means, look under the microscope at a piece of brain, and you see this little protein collected. That's what CTE is. We had a group of scientists get together and say, well, is this because this protein that develops is called tau? And there are many, many different types of diseases that are associated with tau deposition. And tau deposition is even associated with normal aging. A bunch of scientists get together around 2015, 2016, and tried to figure out if CTE was its own unique disease. And what they came up with was a preliminary diagnostic criteria that's pathologic. So if you look down the microscope and you see the tau around the little blood vessels, that's CTE, preliminary. That's all it is. It's not a clinical disease. It's an observation. It's a finding. It has no symptoms associated with it. We don't know what causes it. We just know that this exists. All right. It's a protein accumulation, not a disease. Then you have concussion, and concussion is a head injury. There are different grades of head injury, and I really don't like the term mild traumatic brain injury, which means basically what that kind of is used loosely to describe a brain injury, something that injures the brain that doesn't have a great structural consequence to it, opposed to a severe traumatic brain injury where you actually damage brain cells and whatnot. So it's sort of a gradient. And I think that any brain injury is a big deal. So I don't really like the term mild traumatic brain injury, but it is out there. And concussion would be a type of mild traumatic brain injury, because when you have a concussion, you don't get a structural or an anatomic change to the brain. So a concussion is a mild traumatic brain injury. We know that people who have concussions, almost all of them get better. And there are a few people who have concussions that will have symptoms that linger. They can linger for weeks, months, even years if the concussion isn't properly treated. That's not CTE. Those are issues related to a post-concussive issue. And I think the easiest way to kind of conceptualize that is using, I'm going to steal from a guy named Mickey Collins, who's a brilliant doc down at the University of Pittsburgh, UPMC, who says that concussion fights dirty, and whatever you bring to the table, it's going to use against you. So if you have a history of motion sickness, if you have a concussion, you're going to have symptoms that are related to kind of motion and vestibular and motion type sickness stuff. If you have a history of anxiety and depression, you're going to have symptoms that may look like anxiety and depression. We have these underlying vulnerabilities within ourselves. And when we have concussions, the concussion will fight dirty and take advantage of those things. And if we don't treat it, those symptoms can linger. And there are types of concussions, particularly those that involve anxiety and depression and mood disorders, that are very challenging to treat. But again, that's not CTE. CTE is the collection of protein. That's it. Concussion is a head injury. And then you got this idea of subconcussive hits. The idea originally was that you have multiple concussions, that's going to lead to this protein deposition in your brain. And we haven't found that to be true. There doesn't appear to be a relationship between a concussion, multiple concussions, or the severity of concussions and the subsequent development of CTE. You have about 20% of this biased population who's never had a concussion yet have CTE. So instead of taking a scientific route about this and saying, what else could it be? Well, let's confirm our bias and say, well, it's subconcussive hits. And it's a great marketing scheme because it's like you can't prove the non-existence of God, right? You can't prove the non-existence of something. And this is a complete science fiction, what a subconcussive hit is. If you ask 10 neuroscientists what's a subconcussive hit, you're going to get 10 different answers. Nobody knows. The way that it's put forward in the press, this repetitive subconcussive hit, is that these add up over time and then lead to this deposition of tau and CTE. But we can't measure subconcussive hits. We have no idea what it is. A huge review came out last year looking at about 56 papers or so that had used the word subconcussion, found that they were unreliable, didn't use the term. There wasn't enough evidence to suggest that a subconcussive hit can cause long-term brain injury. So that's kind of how subconcussive came up. And the real problem with it is that it implies that every contact to the head is pathologic, meaning every contact the head has is going to result in a disease. And we know that's not true. We're not that vulnerable. If that was true, it would look like a George Romero movie out there, right? Walking Dead. It would be in a lot of really serious epidemics of people with these neurocognitive and dementia issues. You know, if you think about subconcussive and measure it, I've heard 3 Gs, I've heard 10 Gs, nobody really knows. And to put that into perspective, a pillow fight's 20 Gs, jump roping, running down the stairs, trampolines. I mean, we're exposed to these mythical subconcussive hits all the time. That's not to say that we should be hitting our heads repeatedly over and over. Right? If we can limit the amount we hit our head, no matter what we're doing, I think that's fantastic. And I think that we've done a lot of that with football to try to even, if subconcussive hit even exists, at least taking a step to say, well, okay, we don't know, but let's not hit heads.
There's this assumption that in football, in youth football specifically, that we're repetitively letting kids run around the field and do this, just repetitively hitting heads. And that's not true. So I don't see how anything can be, I guess, diagnosed is the term. I don't even know what the term is in the medical world to say, oh, you've had this many subconcussive hits. I mean, how is that even possible?
You can't, because you can't measure it. You have no threshold for it. You can't. It's something you can't measure. So let's blame it on something we can never measure or disprove. And right. But you know, what you're referring to is the mythology of football being woodpecker ball. You know, that we're out here constantly banging heads for 2 hours every single night. And, you know, we're throwing people down like it's sumo wrestling, and it, you know, and nothing could be further than the truth. And it's if subconcussive hit is really a thing, well, you know, this repetitive stuff isn't happening in football. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense.
No, it. I'm so glad you touched on that. And to your point, Steve, too, it seems like, and I'm going to use a football analogy, that the folks who want the game to go away keep moving the goalpost. The dialogue keeps changing. First, and this is from a chronological perspective, the talk was TBI concussions, right? So we're addressing those things. And I say that the youth tackle football community is addressing those like no other sport. Then we start moving down the road from that to CTE discussion and create a whole bunch of confusion in the football culture. And now we're talking about subconcussive activity. It seems like whenever we're learning more about each item, the goalpost seems to be intentionally moved. Do you see it that way as well?
Yeah, definitely. Part of it is that science is advancing, and science is slow. It's not sexy. You know, it isn't this immediate, you know, all of a sudden we have everything figured out. I mean, to look at the idea that football is going to result in all of these issues later in life is too simplistic, particularly given the huge number of people that have played football over the last 100 years. And it removes the idea that other risk factors or other problems in your life, like low socioeconomic status, divorce, substance abuse, these things are irrelevant. That if you played football, oh, you know, it's football. That's not to say that these people aren't having symptoms. And this is the problem when a new theory comes out, like what you're talking about, Ron, and everybody jumps on it, and we get into this frame of everybody likes to have the same thoughts. Everyone wants to be part of a herd and a group. And that's the frame that this has taken. And it's become a contagion in our media and in our minds. And it's difficult to deviate from that. When these scientific theories show up, whether it was the classic examples of, hey, wait a second, maybe the sun doesn't revolve around the earth, or hey, maybe the world is round, those weren't popular. And it took a long time for that pendulum of truth to swing back to the other side. And I always say that pendulum of truth is really like a guillotine, because a lot of people lost their heads for that. And, you know, I feel like, you know, I'm losing my head over this. You know, I'm at the forefront of that. But that's how science works. We take a new theory, we put it on the table, we bash it up, and we see what's left. That's how science works. And that's not happening here. When you have 60-some neurotrauma experts from around the planet write a letter to The Lancet saying, hey, this media narrative is hurting people. And you have another 26 neurotrauma experts saying, we don't know enough to even consider banning youth football at this point. You have to start to wonder, when are people going to listen to the wider scientific audience here and stop calling them science deniers, when we're actually trying to say, hey, we have to follow a scientific process. And you may not like it, but it takes time. It is slow. It's not hot and sexy like death and destruction. And we have to do it the right way so we get the right answers and can help people. It's not science denying. And it isn't saying that these people aren't having symptoms or these people aren't having problems. It's just saying that we can't blame it all on football. We can't point back to a protein that we have no idea what the role it may play in it. So when you move the goalposts, some of that is because we're advancing the science, and some of that is we're trying to move the goalposts to fit the science, because the science isn't really convincing to some of this. So we've got to try to fit our narrative in here somewhere rather than doing it in a proper scientific way. So there's two kind of things happening depending on where you are. I mean, there's some wonderful people that are advancing the science, and we're learning more and more about this. You know, every week there's a new paper where something interesting is coming out and we're learning more. You know, some of it's intentional. I think a lot of it's just the way that science works too.
Well, as far as science goes, I've definitely learned something today. Science is not sexy.
Yeah. I think I knew that though, but I didn't.
It is not.
It is not. It is not. Yeah, but it's needed, right? Whether it's sexy or not, it's needed, because, you know, guys like us, Ron and Steve, who are not into that realm of medicine and science and everything else that you're involved with, we wouldn't know the difference. That's why I asked you about subconcussive, concussion, TV. I mean, you hear so much thrown on the wall to get rid of youth football. It's like, okay, which one is it, guys? Help us out here, because I think we're intelligent enough adults to know that we don't want to cause damage to our own children. That's right. Thought number one. We don't. We got to trust somebody in this debate to follow, because I could tell you, if somebody came out tomorrow and said, your son is damaged for life, no more. That's it. It's done. We have the proof. Here it is, this and that. I just personally have not seen it.
I agree. And I said, if the minute I find something that says, hey, wait a second, I'm convinced I'm putting my son in danger, he's not playing anymore. And I'll be the first person to do that. I have no agenda. Again, this is about my son for me, and trying to tell people how I went through my decision-making process. And, you know, if something comes up somewhere and you look at the science to say, ooh, you know, wait a second here, let's take a look. And you look at the sport of football and say, how are you going to respond to this? And if there isn't a great answer, then they don't play. And that's an important takeaway, is that, you know, this isn't, I think that a lot of the people that I've talked to would feel the same way. Nobody wants their children injured. Nobody wants to injure the children that they coach. I mean, I love these kids. You know, we go trick or treating together. We have, these are like a family, and I don't want any of these children hurt. And I even on the other team, when somebody turns an ankle or something in a game, it's upsetting, because I know these kids love this game and they love to play it.
So here's an interesting question. I don't know if you've ever been asked this, but since you brought it up, I'm going to ask you.
Oh God.
When you go trick or treating, what's your costume?
Last year, I wasn't anything because I got stuck in the Red Sox World Series parade traffic, and I was late getting home. The year before that, I was Wolverine.
I wasn't expecting that on the show today, but that is good information. Just in case I need a Wolverine lookalike someday.
The Hugh Jackman Wolverine.
The Hugh Jackman. Yeah. Okay.
Gotcha. I wasn't wearing that tidy yellow thing.
Thanks for the clarification. I have a better image now. I don't know if that's ever going to leave my head, but I have.
I love it. All right. Well, we're getting close to wrapping up this edition of the Chain Crew podcast. Ron, do you have any closing thoughts or questions for Peter?
I have a thought and a quick question. The thought is, you know, we look at who's coaching these kids. A large number are fathers. Fathers are not going to intentionally want to put kids in harm's way. In fact, we're all seeking the truth. I'd be the first in line to remove my child from play if I felt that there was that kind of inherent risk. And I think most folks would be. And then that's missed a lot. The question I have for you, though, is you and I both, although I would not fit into a Wolverine costume anytime soon, I got to be honest with you, is we both are guys growing up in the 70s, which probably speaks to why you're a Steeler fan, why I'm a Cowboy fan. How do you pull off repping a Steelers jersey in the Boston area and make it out alive? I need to know that. Help me out with that, Peter.
You know, I get a lot of crap walking down the street with my Steelers hat on in the winter, you know, my knit cap. It's all good fun here, I think, you know. And I'll say the last 2 years we've gone down to the Steelers Patriots game down in Pittsburgh. You know, because, you know, I'm hanging with Merrill, I make my kid wear all the Steelers gear. Nice. And you know, he loves Tom Brady, right? And he's terrified last time we were there that Tom Brady was going to see him wearing Steelers gear. And so I was like, no, I think Tom's busy, man. And so he's wearing his Tom Brady jersey under his Steelers stuff just in case he sees Tom's and he can pull the shirt off and go, my dad's making me.
That is classic.
Right? So, but he's so, thinking it through, though, right?
He's thinking it through.
Very
he's
smart.
Got his loyalties.
He's thinking loyalties. It through. I would just ask, though, and I'll wrap it up on my end, is there ever a chance that you might be wearing the Wolverine outfit under the Steeler jersey? Is that something that I should be aware of?
Maybe offline we can do that sometime.
Fair enough.
Next time in California, we'll have a couple of beers, and I'll put on my Hugh Jackman Wolverine leather jacket and claws, and we'll
I love it. I'll take you up on that. I'll take you up on that for sure.
Well, you know what? I'm going to leave it at this. You got me completely excited for Halloween coming up. So,
months away. It is my favorite holiday. I'm not going to lie. I mean, I take the week off. I really do. I usually take the week off. This past year, I had to teach. I had some things going on. But everybody I work with knows that Halloween is my day. But I love that holiday. But I got a couple of things I want to wrap up with quick, guys, if you don't mind me taking the soapbox here for a minute or two.
No, sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, when I started this whole thing, it really kicked off for me with that Yahoo piece in 2017. And I opened it up with, you know, being the only neuropathologist on earth lets this kid play football. And at the time, I felt very much on an island, and I didn't know there were other people that thought like I thought or had done the work that I had done. And it's been an incredible experience the last few years, meeting guys like you, becoming friends with all you guys and working with what you're doing in California and getting your help out here in Massachusetts. And I treasure your friendship and very much, and along that with a lot of the people I've met across the country. And, you know, I never imagined a day where I'd be throwing around numbers of close to 100 other neurotrauma people out there saying, hey, wait a second, you know, we got to stop and take a look at that. What's going on? I feel really good about that. It's been an incredible transformation. And I'm thankful to have known you guys.
We're with you.
And, you know, two other things, you know, I don't think any other sport has made a more radical transformation in response to safety concerns than youth football. And it's crazy the amount of stuff that we do to keep kids safe. And I think that, you know, it's a great thing to be able to come out and say, well, we're already doing a lot of stuff, and to have people give you blank stares and be like, oh, really? And coaching your kids. You guys talk about coaching your children. We're all parents here. We're all volunteers. And we do this because, you know, we love our kids and we want our kids to have this great experience. And you want to share that with them. Yeah, there's a small set of people out there that think we're trying to relive glory days and run our kids up the ladder to the NFL. And I'm just trying to keep my kid off the Xbox and do something he enjoys doing. You know, and I get to do it with him.
Amen.
And I got a question for you guys now, because you know, you reach this point as a parent coach where you start thinking, well, how much longer am I going to do it? You know, because that relationship that a young athlete has with a coach is so important. Should that be somebody other than a parent at some point? When do you hand that over? And you know, I'm not going to be able to coach him forever because, you know, I'm a limited skill set coach. You know, I'm not going to be able to teach him some of the other things about the game. I'm a film junkie. I watch a lot of film, and I love the intellectual component of the game. You know, I got to hand him off to somebody soon. And what do you guys think about parent coaching transfers?
You know, the time you have with your child is, and I'm an older guy, so I don't mind saying that, is so fleeting. right? That window of opportunity to spend time with your child in any capacity is so important, so precious. I think if you do it the right way, I believe there's a couple schools of thought. I've talked to coaches over the years who say, I'm absolutely not coaching my son from day one. Then you got coaches that are saying, I'm only person coaching my son. I think it's what really fits for you and your family and what that relationship is. I know this, you'll never be able to replace that time. So whether you're coaching him, taking him to the movie, buying a miniature Wolverine costume for him on Halloween, whatever it is, spend that time together, sir. Spend
it together. That's so true. That's true. You know, and I was telling him the other day, we were cleaning some stuff up and we had some great success. We won a bunch of championships together. And one of them was a come from behind win, a team who hadn't lost in 4 years. And we were the only team to beat them in 4 years. And we beat them in the Super Bowl. And I said to him, I'm going to be buried with that ring. When I die, I'll be buried with that ring. It was one of the best moments in sports that we had together. And I'll remember that forever.
No, but you know, isn't that the cool part about all of this? You know, we have all this debate about youth football. Governments getting involved, all of it, just the whole narrative of it. And what we're talking about right here, to me on a personal level, is what's most important. I've been involved in the sport for 18 years. Both of my boys, my youngest is graduating college in 3 weeks, 4 weeks up in Colorado. So my boys have been long gone, but I continue to be a part of the sport because I loved that connection to my community first and foremost, but to the kids in my community and watching these young boys grow up and go on to high school and graduate and go into the military, go on to college, whatever it is they did. You know, for me, that's the biggest part. And, you know, ultimately, Peter, your son, if he goes on to other coaches, which he probably will, right? That's only going to make him grow, either as a player or a person, and just being able to experience those other forms of coaching and mentoring and things like that. And to me, like you said, you know, go out there and brag about yourselves, brag about being a youth football coach, brag about what you do in your community. I think we do not talk about that enough. And that honestly could be almost one whole full podcast in itself.
Oh, absolutely.
About what we do for the kids in our community. And that's what drives me. I don't get paid to do this. I don't want to take one penny from doing this. It doesn't matter to me. I just want the sport to be viable so that the kids can have that opportunity to be around guys like ourselves on the football field and get that unique experience. And to me, that's what's most important.
It's the heart of football. Yep. And that's why we do this. Outside looking in, I don't always think we do enough to tell that story, because what we're talking about now, right? Not CTE, not legislation. We're talking about the heart of the sport that really tackle football is almost alone in that category in terms of what it brings for that relationship. And we need to do a better job talking about it.
No, definitely. Yep. We definitely do.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, that's going to wrap up this edition of the Chain Crew podcast. And Peter, when we have you on next time, that's we're going to devote the next podcast with you to talking about coaching and getting a little bit more in depth into what we do in our local communities, right? Because I think when you asking that question is very important, and we need to use these avenues and these venues that we have to be able to talk about that a little bit more. So I thank you for bringing that up.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you see these stories, all the charity work and the things that football teams do, how they rally around communities that are struggling. And yeah, I think there's a lot of beauty to this game, a lot of beautiful people in this game, and it gets that gets lost in this, the noise.
Great way to wrap up this edition of the Chain Crew podcast. I want to thank you, Dr. Peter Cummings, our very good friend, and we consider you a friend, for coming on with us today, and we definitely will see you again very soon.
My pleasure, my brothers.
Thanks for listening to another Chain Crew podcast, powered by the California Youth Football Alliance. Make sure to follow them on Facebook and Twitter. Plus, stay in touch on their website, cayfa.org.